It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how the long quest to find a vaccine for HIV could set the stage for a more successful vaccine effort for the novel coronavirus. First, there are some things that just seem to go with summer. Family vacations, backyard cookouts, fireflies, baseball for a few, and pie. Of course, you've got your various fruit and berry pies, but don't forget about the no-bake refrigerator pies, perfect for those hot and humid days. And if you want to stretch out those cherries, blueberries, and the rest of the summer bounty into the fall and winter, maybe can some of your own fillings. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we're going to cover all of that and more. Christina Ward is a food writer from Cudahy and master food preserver for Milwaukee County. She's the author of two books, including American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O, and Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back. I know it's a challenging time for everyone, but we can still get outdoors and we can still make pie.
Fantastic. Is there a pie, Christina, that you look forward to in the summertime more than any other?
We're in the midst of cherry season right now. And cherry pie, there's nothing that says summer more to me in Wisconsin than cherry pie. And cherry picking is something that families can do safely outside with a mask and distance. And you can still get outside. And I know the cherries are ripe right now in Door County and in other cherry growing areas.
A bane of fruit pie making, and you've written about this, Christina, is if we just throw the fruit in there and cook it up, the liquid from the fruit can really spoil the crust. How do we prepare our fruit fillings to make sure that just doesn't happen?
The tried and true way is to essentially pre-cook that filling, is to heat up, say we're making a cherry pie, and I think we've got that recipe up on the website. If we're making that cherry pie, cook that fruit first, so the heat helps release the juice. And then we do the thickening, and that's called making a slurry, and then adding it to the pie crust. Doing that way helps ensure that you're going to have a nice thickened pie and the crust remains crispy.
And we thicken it up just kind of like we'd thicken up any kind of sauce with cornstarch or something like that?
So if you're using your fresh cherries, a little bit of cornstarch, even some folks use a little bit of flour or tapioca. All of those things are okay. Anything that helps make a little bit of a thickening. If you're using it to make a canning filling, then you have to use a very specialized item called clear gel, which can be purchased online or at many of the Mennonites Amish stores throughout Wisconsin.
We've got that classic cherry pie recipe you shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. Well, let's get into that delicious pie crust. You've also shared just a good go-to recipe for our pie dough. Again, that's at WPR.org/Food Friday. What is the key to making a successful pie crust?
You know, pie crust is one of those things. The simpler, the better. I mean, in the ingredients, it's just a few ingredients and everyone has their own secret version of it. You'll hear variations about adding vodka because it evaporates, the alcohol evaporates. Butter versus lard versus Crisco. I think it's more about technique. Have whatever fat you're adding, and I prefer using butter, have it really, really cold. Don't overwork the dough. Make sure the water is really cold. The best way to do that on a hot day is just get a little bit of cold water, stick an ice cube in it. And as you're getting everything ready, that water will be cold enough. And just put it together with a pastry blender by hand. I think that works great. And get it going and don't fuss too much with it.
Should there be, and this is something I always wonder about, should there be visible like little blobs of butter left or do I have to work those completely in with the flour?
Yeah, it sounds like you've made pie before.
I'm a little scared of it. I'm not going to lie, but I have tried. Yeah.
Yeah. Ideally, you should still see the like globs of butter. That's what builds the layers. The little fat globules, then as the butter melts or the fat melts, that is what helps make your pie crust flaky and it builds the layers. So that's the secret about don't overwork the dough. You don't want it 100% perfectly blended. You want to see just like pea size. When there's pea size pieces of your fat in there in the dough, then you're ready to go and just roll it out and get it into a pie plate. And I'm a fan also of blind baking. And what that means is laying maybe a piece of tin foil or better yet, parchment paper. And you can buy fancy pie stones, but I just keep a jar of old beans and make sure nobody tries to use those for cooking. And you bake the crust, you pre-bake it, and that helps also to ensure you get a nice flaky crust, and it doesn't get too moist, kind of, because soggy pie in the middle is never a good outcome.
We are talking about pies on this edition of Food Friday. Christina Ward is with us, a food writer from Cudahy, master food preserver for Milwaukee County. We're making some great summertime pies in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite pie to make or to have someone else make and then you get to eat it? Do you have questions about solving some of your problems? Christina has already solved two of my mistakes in just the last few minutes already. Or do you have a secret to your success when it comes to pies? Do you have a no-bake kind of pie you like to make? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Oh, and what kind of berries or cherries or fruit do you like best in your pie? Christina, I just mentioned that no-bake pie idea, and on our hotter, more humid days in Wisconsin, that sounds like a nice option. What are some of the things we can play with when we don't want to actually bake it?
There is a great old-fashioned recipe, and I say old-fashioned because everybody's grandma or great-grandma made it, and it was from the back of a can of the sweetened condensed milk, and so from Borden's. And folks will probably recognize this type of recipe, and it's that basic sweetened condensed milk and some lemon juice or orange juice, and you whip that all together with a little bit of cream cheese, and you stick that in a graham cracker crust, and you've got pie. It can be as simple as that. There's a recipe we shared on the website for today, a little bit more complicated, a little bit fancier, if you will, but still a refrigerator pie for blueberries. And it uses ricotta cheese.
Yeah, tell us more about this one. This one, I don't think I've ever seen a blueberry ricotta pie before. What happens with this guy?
Yeah, I wanted to share something that is a little bit more unusual, and I thought that would be fun. And so instead of a graham cracker crust, this is a nut crust. And so it uses a combination of walnuts and almonds, and you can use really any kind of nut combination you want. It comes through the sweetening with a little honey as well. And then you could use a little a thickening agent, which is a little almond butter, or you can substitute tahini. And you just either roast those nuts or keep them raw, grind them all up, mix it together till it comes, you know, as a kind of a chunk, and then press that into the pie plate. Cool it. You can do a quick cool in the freezer. And then when you mix mashed up blueberries with whole blueberries and the ricotta cheese with a little sweetening, maple syrup and blueberries go great together. You've got a really nice, not super overly sweet as you would with the sweetened condensed milk, but a nice version, a little maybe a gourmet version of a refrigerator pie.
And you've got one of the best warnings I've seen in a recipe on that one for those almonds in the crust. You say, make sure you're not using, you know, smoked or, you know, flavored or whatever almonds. You're going to get a big surprise, I guess, if you use
you sure
something
will.
Like that.
You sure will. Smoked, there's so many flavored almonds out there, and that's a great healthy snack. But, you know, watch closely in the pantry. And usually if I put a warning on a recipe, that's usually because that mistake has happened somewhere along the line.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Eau Claire. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I had a raspberry cream cheese pie out at a restaurant, and I've been wanting to make it. I have some fresh raspberries from the garden, and I'm just wondering if you have a good recipe for how to do that.
Ooh.
Are you looking for a refrigerator pie?
What I've heard is that you, like you said earlier, you cook the raspberries in a slurry with some thickener and put it on cream cheese on a baked pie shell and just add a few raspberries. But I don't know, you know, how
sure.
much of anything to make. And I just wonder sure. what I'm guessing from the taste.
Yeah. And so that sounds like one of those great hybrid kind of like a chess pie where there's like a cheese base with a fruit on top. And so what that means is it's super forgiving. I would guess about a pint of raspberries is enough. And if you cook those down. It's essentially you're making two pies. You're making a cheesecake pie, and then you're making a raspberry pie on top of that and kind of marrying those two together. And that can be just fantastic. You could do a refrigerator version of that as well by doing following the Philadelphia cream cheese brand has like the no-bake cheesecake. You could do that and then put your raspberry slurry on top, or you can do it as a baked cheesecake pie, and that would be a little bit more complicated. You'd have to bake your crust, blind bake it for at least 25 minutes, make your cheesecake batter, and then carefully pour that in the pie crust, make your raspberry pie slurry, carefully pour that on top, and then bake everything together.
Kathy, good luck. Hope that helps. We are talking about summer pie making and baking with Christina Ward. She's a food writer from Cudahy and master food preserver for Milwaukee County. We've got three recipes that she shared. They're posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. There's a classic pie dough, a cherry pie, and a blueberry ricotta refrigerator pie. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite pie this time of year? Are you making something right now or planning to make something this weekend? Tell us about it. Or do you have a pie problem that you need solved? I bet Christina will have an answer for you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We continue our conversation about how to make awesome summer pies with Christina Ward. She's a food writer from Cudahy and a master food preserver for Milwaukee County. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of pies have you made lately? What matches the summer for you? What pie tastes like summer for you? Is there a berry or fruit that you like to work with, or a no-bake pie? Or do you have a question for Christina? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Find some recipes from Christina at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll go back to your calls now. Lynette is with us in Madison. Lynette, hi.
Oh, hi. This is kind of interesting. I've never made a pie before in my life. And just yesterday, I was at a Pex market in Spring Green, and I picked up two large jars of one of peach pie filling and the other apple pie filling. And do you just buy a crust or make a crust and then pour it in there and bake it?
That is absolutely what you do. That's one of the benefits of actually canning your own pie filling, too, is so when you're feeling lazy on a day that you don't want to do all that cooking, you can get a pre-made pie crust, whether that is a pre-shaped one or a flat one. And I would always recommend, even with the pre-made pie filling, is to par-bake that crust so it gets nice and flaky and not soggy. And then pour your pie filling in and then bake for another, for apple or peach, maybe another 20, 25 minutes. You could zhuzh that up and make like a quick oatmeal nut streusel and put that on top too. And all of a sudden, your jar of pie filling just became pretty fancy.
You're going to be a pie pro in no time, Lynette. Thanks a lot for calling in. And I know before we go back to callers, Christina, you are big on preserving. And even if people aren't growing their own, you can go to the you pick places that are open, or sometimes that you can buy a crate of peaches in bulk or this or that in bulk. You're a big fan of preserving now and then enjoying the fruits of your labor literally through fall and winter.
I am. To me, it's a taste of summer. When it's February and it's really cold, though it's hard to think about it being cold right now, there is nothing like knowing that you can, go into the pantry and pick up a jar out of, your stock, your own personal stock. You know exactly where it came from. It tastes the way you want it to taste, and you can whip up a pie.
We got an email from Grant who says, my favorite pie is parsnip pie, made from roasted parsnips, made with some honey and a bit of orange zest. It's killer texture, Grant says, is similar to a pumpkin pie, but far better. Now, parsnips, I forget about this, but you roast them, and they do get a little sweet. What do you think, Christina?
Sure. That's a very old English style from English cooking, to use root vegetables, especially as a pie filling. What the roasting does is the heat kind of caramelizes the sugars that are in the potato, sweet potato, carrot, or parsnip. And when you mix it again with more honey and other things, you know, sweeteners, it bakes up to a kind of a pie that is, could be savory. You could make that savory too. In England, you know, in the, say the Renaissance era, they didn't have a crust. They would just make those and call those puddings. And that's where you see sometimes old Yankee recipes that actually call for mashed potatoes, and you see mashed potato pies. It's a sweet pie. But yeah, there's a lot of, there's a long history of using root vegetables as well as squashes as pie fillings.
That sounds fantastic. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Travis is with us in Mercer. Travis, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Travis?
Yeah, I have a question. Every time I make a pecan pie, I can never get the bottom middle of the crust to finish cooking all the way when the rest of the pie is all done. When we cut into it, the middle of the pie crust is always still pretty gooey. So I was just wondering if any advice on that.
I've had that too, Christina. You know, I'm worried it's getting burned on the top, but it's still not quite done in the middle.
I've got a couple tips for you. I love pecan pie. Yeah. So first, blind baking. Again, if you blind bake that crust, and if you can actually, it's a little futzy, and you can actually buy essentially crust covers that cover the edge of the crust and protect it from getting overcooked or burnt, and cook through the actual pie crust. So that's something to look for. But you can also make it yourself with tin foil. You just kind of cut long strips of tin foil and essentially very carefully cover the edge crust where you've kind of either with your thumb or with a fork kind of pressed it into the pie plate at the edge. And so protect the edge and really par bake that crust. And that will really make a difference. And the crust, bake it longer than you think. Half hour, 45 minutes before you put in your the pecan pie filling, and then bake it through. And you'll be surprised. You'll get a really nice, thorough bake on your pie.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We are talking about pie, making great summer pies in particular. Back to your calls. Let's go to Andy with us in Mount Horeb. Andy, hello.
Hi. One of the pies I like is elderberry. And I was coming back from Madison today along a road. I won't say which one. I saw about 50 lineal feet worth of elderberries. And they're just starting to, all the blossoms are gone now, and they're just starting to get some color. And I think they'll be ready in a week and a half or 2 weeks, and I'll be making a pie and some elderberry jam.
That sounds fantastic, Andy. Yes. And don't worry, your secret's safe with me. I don't think I could pick an elderberry out of a lineup. Have you worked with elderberries, Christina?
I have. Elderberries are fantastic. Again, a little futzy because they're small to pick. But here's a tip for everybody. If you don't have 50 linear feet of elderberries, is apples are a good partner with a lot of what they call hedgerow, you know, kind of wild growing fruit. So if you've got like some great wild blackberries or wild black raspberries or elderberries, you can match those with apple, and apples will kind of, they won't overpower the berries. So you'll still get a really, the flavor of say elderberry coming through, and the apples will help take up some of the mass, if you will. And you can make a whole pie out of maybe not as many elderberries.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for sharing that. We'll go to Teresa now with us in Madison. Teresa, hi.
Hello. I was brought up in England, and a traditional pastry is, we call it half fat to flour. So, and of course, it's not cups, but if you had a pound of flour, the fat would be 8 ounces, and the fat would be half margarine and half lard with a sprinkle of salt. And that's just absolutely standard. And I still bake it like that. And people often comment, especially at Christmas, they say, oh, your pastry is really good. And it's what I would call just a plain old recipe, but it is excellent. The lard makes it so rich. It's lovely.
Fantastic. Christina, you said earlier, keep that dough simple.
Keep the dough simple. And if you found it, a lot of it is the technique. If you found a ratio for the fats that work for you, stick with it. Practice makes perfect. It really does. So, you know, I always say, just jump in. Nobody complains too much about eating a pie if it didn't turn out perfectly. But it's not uncommon to use a half and half on the fat recipe. So butter to margarine, butter to Crisco sometimes. Half butter, half Crisco is popular. So again, whatever ratios work for you, stick with it.
Teresa, thanks for calling in. Time for one more call. Russ is with us in Pleasant Springs. Russ, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. You had a recent caller that asked about the raspberry cheese pie she had at a restaurant. I missed some of the details. If you buy a preformed pie crust, do you always have to bake that? And number two, how do you spread a brick of Philadelphia cream cheese? What do you do? Do you let it warm up, or what do you do with that?
So with the Philadelphia brick cream cheese, I'm going to go in reverse order, is you do bring it up like you would a butter. So bring it up to room temperature and then mix it. If you've got a stand mixer, fantastic. If you don't, a hand mixer works great. And yes, with the refrigerator or frozen pie crust, you do have to bake them. So they are essentially raw and then frozen or refrigerated. And, you know, so there's two different styles. But yes, you have to bake them. And yes, bring that cream cheese up to room temperature. If you're extra lazy, the Philadelphia brand actually makes like a tub of cheesecake filling. You can just buy the filling ready made.
Thanks for that call. One quick emergency question. Brock from Madison couldn't stay on the line. He had a bumper crop of mulberries and wants advice on making pies with them. I say emergency because mulberries don't keep too long.
They do not. Mulberries can be finicky because that stem goes all the way down. So here's what I'd recommend. Cook them down. Just cook them plain with just enough water to cover them so they don't scorch. And then use like I'm a big fan of the conical sieve. And so to separate the mulberries from the stems, and then you'll have mulberry pulp, and then make your filling and slurry right from that, you know, sweeten it, thicken it with a little flour or cornstarch, however you want, and then go to town and make your pie.
Sounds great. Christina, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's always my pleasure. I hope everyone is inspired to, if they don't make a pie, at least eat some pie this weekend.
I think I will. Christina Ward is a food writer from Cudahy and master food preserver from Milwaukee County. We talked with her about summer pies. We've got three of her recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. A great easy pie dough, a cherry pie, and a blueberry ricotta refrigerator pie. Give us a shot. Let them know how they went. Coming up after the news, a science reporter tells us how decades of research into a vaccine for HIV have set the research world up for a possible quick turnaround for a COVID-19 vaccine. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, utility companies in Wisconsin can resume shutoffs for people unable to pay their bills during the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll talk to the head of Consumer Protection Organization who's calling on companies to be flexible as the outbreak continues. First, back in 1984, scientists discovered the life-threatening virus that causes HIV and led to the AIDS epidemic. The U.S. Health Secretary at the time vowed to find a vaccine within 2 years. Although other treatment methods have been developed, 36 years later, there's still no vaccine to stop HIV. Now the world is facing another deadly virus in COVID-19. Our guest has been reporting on how the decades of research, collaboration, and development to find an HIV vaccine have set the stage for the scientists working now to combat the new coronavirus. Carolyn Johnson is a science reporter for The Washington Post. For the last few months, she's been covering the developments in the search for a coronavirus vaccine. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with that hunt for an HIV vaccine. It turned out this is a very hard virus to vaccinate against. What were some of the challenges?
Well, HIV is a very different virus than the coronavirus. It is devious and has really resisted our attempts to create a vaccine. We haven't been successful there, partially because this virus can integrate into our own cells and hide out there. It mutates. And our own immune systems aren't good at battling it down. And that's in contrast to coronavirus, where many people recover. Most people recover naturally. So we have really good evidence our immune systems can do this. And that gives us hope for a vaccine against it.
In a recent piece, you write that the infrastructure that was developed in the hunt for an AIDS vaccine is really paying dividends for COVID-19 in the hunt to find a vaccine for this coronavirus. Can you talk about some of how that's worked?
Yeah, so a lot of people might hear that this is a parallel to the HIV vaccine and be depressed because we clearly don't have one yet. But the thing is, we've done so much work on HIV. It has taught us so much about the immune system, about how to make vaccine technologies better, about how to run clinical trials, how to do outreach to kind of underserved and marginalized people who you need to recruit into those kinds of trials. All of that infrastructure has been developed for HIV, and now COVID can go fast because we're piggybacking on all of that expertise. So we don't have an HIV vaccine yet, but all the work that we've been doing trying to get to one actually has allowed us to pick that stuff, just ranging from basic science to kind of how you do the outreach to people to get them to participate in clinical trials.
Have researchers and labs that were working on an HIV vaccine, have they actually pivoted? Are those actually some of the same labs that are working now on a coronavirus vaccine?
Yeah, it's huge overlap. So when I talked to one researcher in Boston who has been working most of his career on HIV vaccine research, he had his lab meeting in January. They discussed that day that there was this mysterious pneumonia in Wuhan, China. At that point, there were only 40 cases, I think, which seems mind-bogglingly small now, but they were extremely concerned about it. That night, the Chinese researchers put the genome of that virus online, and his lab started working on it then. And the vaccine candidate that they're working on is directly influenced by the work that they've done on HIV. It uses the same kind of basic technology. It uses a harmless cold virus to ferry into your body like genes that are going to trigger the right immune response. And instead of genes to trigger kind of an immune response to HIV, they're trying to trigger one to COVID.
Carolyn Johnson is with us, science reporter for The Washington Post, looking at the effort to come up with a vaccine for the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19 and why years of HIV vaccine research, even though they haven't paid off with an HIV vaccine, are actually kickstarting, speeding up the process now. Carolyn, another interesting point you brought up in your piece was that for a while with HIV, they would try one method and then move on to another one. And it sounds like from what you're writing, they're trying a lot of different methods in labs around the world all at the same time.
The amount of energy going into the race to develop a vaccine against coronavirus is really unprecedented. It's not just academic labs or government labs. It's also basically so many companies that are jumping into this. And it is all happening in parallel. That's partially because this virus has really devastated both health and the economy around the world. So it can become just such a big obstacle. Like, everyone wants to develop a vaccine, but it's also because governments have been giving a lot of money to companies to make it financially less risky to jump into this. And that has also just really helped spur lots of different kinds of approaches and scientists into the fight.
We see headlines that, you know, one vaccine or another might be entering, a late stage, getting closer to development. What does that mean as far as where potential vaccines are now and how long they could potentially be in use in the public?
All that depends on what happens in the coming months. So it's the people are making timeline predictions are making them, you know, sort of blind because we haven't even started the trials that will determine whether the vaccine is effective or not. But what's happening is they're scaling up production and manufacturing of many vaccines right now, even though we don't know if they're going to work or not. That's risky because you might have to throw out all that vaccine, but that is something that we haven't had to do before, or we haven't had the opportunity to do before.
And looking at where we are on viruses now, some of the questions that have to be answered, not just does it work, but I guess questions like how long does it work for? And of course, is it safe? Does it have side effects? Can you talk about the range of questions that have to be answered before a mass-produced vaccine starts being given to the public?
These large trials, they're called phase three trials, will go on for months. They will include 30,000 people, and they're going to look for any safety problems. They're going to look for effectiveness, as in, does it prevent infections? Does it make the disease less severe if it doesn't completely protect against infection? And the other thing about vaccines is that they are typically monitored after they're approved through other kind of add-on studies. So even after a vaccine is shown safe and effective, it's not going to end anything, because the trials now, I mean, one of the trials is going to like last for 2 years. I mean, the vaccine will likely be shown effective or not before those 2 years are up, but scientists are going to continue to collect data because they're going to want to know things like, how long does the protection from this vaccine last? If it fades, do you need to get a booster? There's just all kinds of questions that are going to be studied in parallel, potentially, with the approval of the vaccine.
We were talking today mostly mainly about vaccines, but I know there are efforts in the works, and I think you've written some about these, to come up with therapeutics, things that treat us if we get COVID-19. What is out there in that kind of research right now?
Well, you've probably heard about remdesivir, which is a drug that is used in hospitalized patients. There is an inexpensive steroid called dexamethasone, which has been shown to be helpful in patients who require oxygen. So these are not treatments for people with mild cases. Well, I mean, so certainly dexamethasone is not. They're still going to be testing others. But the effort to test treatments is also really ramping up, because some of the greatest hope is on a class of drugs called monoclonal antibodies. They sort of mimic what your immune system could be doing, but optimize it. And those drugs are also going into large scale clinical trials on the hope that they might be useful both as a treatment and potentially as a short-term prevention. It wouldn't last as long as a vaccine, but it might help prevent the disease, particularly in people who might not respond well to a vaccine, for example, elderly people.
As we wrap up, Carolyn, you've been covering a lot of angles over the last few months when it comes to efforts to prevent or treat COVID. What do you have your eye on right now? What is really standing out to you?
Well, the large clinical trials for vaccines, which will really show whether or not they work, are going to be starting at the end of the month. The first one will start, and those are going to be hugely informative. That's really what we need. I know there's a ton of excitement with every scrap of data that comes out, but we can't really tell that much from these early trials. We can know, like, they didn't really seriously injure anyone. People like might have had a fever, you know, we can know that they had these kind of transient effects, but it's in such a small number of people, and they're all really healthy young people. And so we really need to look for the phase three results. And then also the monoclonal antibody studies that are just also beginning are going to be very informative, because there's a lot of hope that those might even be faster than a vaccine. And they're going to be essential in any case. If we have a vaccine, it's not going to get to everyone at once. People might still become sick and need treatments. So we're going to need a combination approach either way. But those are two things to look for.
Carolyn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Carolyn Johnson covers science at The Washington Post. She was with us to share her reporting on how the decades of research for an HIV vaccine has boosted the odds of finding a coronavirus vaccine, hopefully on a short timeline. Coming up, customers who are behind on paying their utility bills can have their services shut off now that a coronavirus Wisconsin moratorium on the practice has been lifted. Our guest tells us about options available for consumers and for utilities. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest shares stories of life in rural Wisconsin during the Great Depression. Now, the Wisconsin Public Service Commission announced at the end of June that utility companies statewide would be able to resume service disconnections for customers behind on their bills. Back in March, Governor Tony Evers placed a moratorium on cutting off service as people and communities grappled with the COVID-19 outbreak. Our next guest joins us to talk about his organization's call for utility companies to be flexible with customers as the public health and economic crisis continues. And you can join in if you have a question about utility service and shutoffs during this time at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom Content is Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, or CUB. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Good to be with you.
Well, bring us up to date, Tom. Why did this moratorium end?
Well, after the public health emergency was vacated by the Supreme Court, there were still orders in place from the PSC that barred disconnections, and the PSC worked with the utilities, and they tried to find a middle lane between allowing shutoffs to resume only if necessary. And so they extended some requirements, like utilities could still waive late payment penalties and things like that. The challenge is that often it's when these disconnection notices go out is the trigger for folks who are in dire straits to apply for energy assistance. Wisconsin has been able to get $8 million in crisis energy assistance through the Federal CARES Act. And there's actually a lot more money than that available through rental assistance programs. And so that's why they were one of the reasons they wanted to allow the notices to proceed. But the challenge is now we're seeing an uptick in cases of coronavirus and the looming shutoff end of the unemployment, federal supplemental unemployment benefits could leave folks in some pretty dire straits. So it is a challenge.
So your organization, the Citizens Utility Board, sent a letter, basically to an open letter to utilities. What kind of things are you hoping to see from them?
Well, we're looking for flexibility and for them to basically delay the actual shutoff of customers until the fall, so we can get through some of these heat waves that we're facing, as well as concern about this recent spike in cases. Just looking at the numbers, we've had more than 6,000 cases of the virus reported just in the past week. This is a real challenging time for folks. So what we'd like to see is utilities be flexible on waiving late payment fees, as well as late payment penalties, as well as maybe changing the threshold where if they usually shut off a person who only owed a couple months utility service, maybe reserve those shutoffs for just more extreme cases.
Who are you most worried about now? Who are the kind of people who are being affected by not just COVID-19 itself, but the economic damage that's putting them in a situation where they can't keep up with those utility bills?
Well, I think that's what's the real concern here is some people have called it, this a second wave of pain or like a tsunami that comes after an earthquake, because you have this whole group of people that during the public health emergency, evictions weren't allowed, landlords were barred from doing evictions, and utilities were barred from disconnecting. And now that that's happened, now that the circumstances are changing and evictions are allowed to go ahead, we're really concerned about folks in all parts of the state that are really out of work as a result of this, and facing the end of that $600 supplemental a benefit that had come for the jobless.
Talking to Tom Content, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, looking at utilities here in the state, people at risk of being shut off because they can't keep up with payments. He says utility companies, he hopes, will be more flexible with them in this tough time. Tom, let's flip things around and talk about if there's somebody listening who's thinking, yeah, I'm behind on my utility bills, or I'm about to be behind. What would you say to them? What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, so there are resources, and there are community action agencies and other nonprofits around the state that are ready to help. Both there's this $8 million in energy assistance available, and so if you don't know who your local vendor is to apply to, WISCAP.org, Wisconsin Community Action Program, has resources, and so does the state. We have links to all these resources on our website, too, CubWI.org. And the other thing that's available through the CARES Act was $25 million in rental assistance from the state. And for residents in Dane and Milwaukee County, as well as Racine and Waukesha, there are local rental assistance programs. So there are a lot of resources available, and we're really trying to get the word out that people should really be, this is the time that people really should be accessing that.
How much do you worry about potential health impacts if people lose their utilities, say their electricity in a hot summer, or their water during a time of pandemic?
No, and that's a real concern, and that the health impacts, I mean, let alone the fact that, you know, how do you shelter in place if you've got no shelter? With the heat waves that's lurking even just this weekend, we're glad that the moratorium is still in effect for this weekend. But I think that you raise a really good point, and I think that's that coupled with the recent surge in cases. I know that the PSC is going to be, when they decided to go down this path of allowing disconnections to resume, they vowed to monitor regular updates from the utilities on how many folks were behind on their bills and what the impact this is having. So they may be in the weeks and months ahead, they're going to be monitoring the situation.
Let's bring on a caller. Brad is with us in Port Washington. Brad, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Nice to talk to you again. My question is actually, with this CARES Act and everything, my question is this selective in the sense that after everything was passed and all that, I got my utility bill, I called Energy Assistance twice, and the answer I got on both times was too bad, so sad, you got $700 in December, you know, hey, no, you don't get anything.
Brad, thanks for the call. Is that a thing, Tom Consents, where people might have maxed out previously and not be eligible this time around?
That's a good question. I'm not sure the answer to that. I know that there's regular energy assistance that is available during the winter months, but I believe that the supplemental from the CARES Act is over and maybe over and above on top of that. But that's a really good question. And one thing that we really hope that will bring more resources to bear is that there's legislation pending in Congress to boost that. The utilities and the consumer advocates together have asked for another $4 billion nationally to be put into energy assistance at this critical time.
Brad, thanks for calling and good luck. We're hearing, Tom, more and more school districts saying, at least the beginning of the school year, it's going to be learn from home. Is that a worry for you if people with kids are worrying about losing their electricity and maybe, you know, the ability to hook up and get online?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's you raise a really good point there. And that's the ability to work from home is work from home is dependent on your ability to have shelter and all that as a baseline. But then what I know the PSC has been working on trying to work with areas that are underserved in terms of broadband and getting basically kind of a lifeline service for broadband so that folks who are in tough financial times can actually access the internet bandwidth they need to do this online education.
In our last minute or so, Tom, just remind us of some of the resources out there for people. Who do they get in touch with if they are in need, say, of energy assistance or some of the other services you've mentioned?
Oh, yeah. So definitely the Wisconsin, it's WHEAP, which is the Wisconsin Home Energy Assistance Program, as well as the rental assistance program. And we do have links to all of that on our COVID-19 page on the website of CubWI.org for the Citizens Utility Board.
And you mentioned utility companies asking for more money from the federal government. Briefly, is there anything at the state level that you think would help?
I think the state is, through the PSC, is monitoring this closely, and they're trying to thread the needle between so that people actually reach out for their energy assistance now, but trying to, you know, avoid the worst impact. So I think this one thing the state could look at is on that broadband issue, pouring more resources potentially into to help folks in dire financial straits with for that online education. That's an issue that I think that needs to be looked at as well.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Tom Content is Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, here in Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about his group's call on utility companies statewide to remain flexible and lenient with customers as the COVID-19 outbreak continues. We also talked about some of the services and assistance available for people around Wisconsin. You can email your experiences to us if this is affecting you. Email ideas@wpr.org. Will Major League Baseball be the same without crowds in the stands? It will be different when things open up a week from today, but stadium sound engineers will try to make up for it with some audio from an official baseball video game. As reported by the Associated Press, baseball teams are going to play to the sounds of a crowd, borrowing an idea from soccer leagues in Europe. The sound will come from the baseball video game MLB The Show. It won't just be background noise. Sound engineers will have 75 different sounds and reactions to work with. So they'll have, I guess, you know, a home team home run cheer, gasps of disappointment when a player strikes out, background murmuring while a relief pitcher warms up, that kind of thing. It makes me wonder, I don't have a live audience on Central Time in general, but would I get more pumped up with some crowd noise? I went online to find some stadium sounds, which is really easy to find, actually. Sarah can bring some of that up for me here. All right, let's try it out now. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about some stuff and then some other stuff. Find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. You'll find a couple few really good ones there. Blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, it's kind of nice. It's kind of fun. I do feel more pumped up talking over that crowd noise. Maybe we'll keep trying it. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Hey, wait, wait. Well, I don't like this as much. Are they booing or are they saying Ruab? Well, we'll have to go back to the drawing board on this one. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.